Bob McChesney will be with us momentarily. He's in Wisconsin, but we'll be doing the show from there. His guest is Eric Kleinenberg, author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, and Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. Your calls are welcome at 217-333-9455. Stay tuned. Media Minutes is coming up next.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
All five members of the Federal Communications Commission appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee on February 1st for a hearing to ostensibly assess the communications marketplace. In reality, the gathering turned out to be a grilling for FCC Chairman Kevin Martin and his tenure. Martin minced no words by declaring his regulatory philosophy from the outset.
The commission has tried to make decisions based on the fundamental belief that a robust competitive marketplace, not regulation, is ultimately the greatest protector of the public interest.
That did not sit well with Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota.
This commission is about regulation, regulators. I always worry a little when I hear regulators shy away from regulation talk.
And the hearing got more confrontational from there. Martin was repeatedly quizzed on his approval of the AT&T Bell South merger with conditions like the preservation of network neutrality that he doesn't fully support. He was also interrogated over the FCC's lack of a national broadband policy, which has resulted in the country's 21st place ranking in the world in terms of broadband availability and service quality, and the agency's penchant for secrecy, especially with regard to plans for revising media ownership rules. One exchange between Martin and Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri was especially telling.
Your new media ownership rules,
yes,
that you've announced that you're going to be changing, will you issue those without seeking comment on the regulatory language?
The commission doesn't always, and some have proposed, that we should actually seek again comment on the specific rule before we adopt it, or somehow release it to the public so that people can see what that is.
That's my question.
Right. And since we've just begun the process, I don't even know what we would change. If so, I don't think I can commit to how we will undergo that process.
All five commissioners will be back on Capitol Hill on February 15th for another hearing in front of the House Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee, which may be even more contentious than the Senate's inquiry.
Media consolidation is this force that people know about in the world today. Everyone seems to be aware that there are a small number of large corporations that own more and more of our media system, and they hear about media consolidation as a problem. But they don't really have stories that connect this abstract thing, ownership, to their own personal lives.
That's New York University Associate Sociology Professor Eric Kleinenberg explaining the impetus behind his new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. It's an in-depth, compelling look at consolidation in the American media landscape over the last 10 years. Kleinenberg spent five of those years crisscrossing the country, assembling stories of how consolidation among radio, TV, and newspapers has affected Americans' views on both the media and the democracy in which they live.
I traveled to big cities and small towns. I talked to people in all kinds of places, red states, blue states. I did not come across hardly anyone who said, I'm so pleased about what's happened to my newspaper since Gannett took it over. You know, I really love my radio stations now that Clear Channel has come on the air.
Fighting for Air uses Clear Channel, Sinclair Broadcasting, and the Tribune Company as exemplars of how consolidation has stripped the localism from local media and led to a homogenization of content. While this trend's been ongoing for decades, it greatly accelerated following the passage of policies such as the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and the virtual colonization of the FCC by the corporations it's supposed to regulate.
I think what we've seen in the last 10 years in this country is an informal shift in policy where it seems to me as if promoting the interests of a small number of big companies has become the overriding objective of these agencies. We have lost sight of these standard public interest obligations. The licensing process has become a rubber stamp process. We don't crack down on corporations that clearly abuse the airwaves.
Kleinenberg gives several proposals for reforming the state of American media. And while many of these involve organizing to fight upcoming policy battles, he says the first real step toward fixing consolidation-related problems is acknowledging that they exist.
We need to get ourselves out of the wonky D.C. debate here and tell the stories of what's happened to our media by connecting those dots.
Connecting those dots also involves citizens working to create spaces, both online and off, where they can speak to themselves and each other without the filter of a corporate distribution mechanism. Fighting for Air hit shelves nationwide last month and is published by Metropolitan Books.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Hi, this is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from Champaign in Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show for you. We've got a guest who's written a highly acclaimed new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. The author of the book, Eric Kleinenberg, joining us on the air from New York City. Eric, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Eric Kleinenberg is a journalist and a professor of sociology at NYU, also the author of Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of a Disaster in Chicago, a highly acclaimed book, and a journalist who's written for Rolling Stone and a number of other publications. But this new book, Eric, that's just come out, has already gotten, I think, probably as much attention as any book on media activism, media policy that I know of. I think it's really really changed the tenor of the debate. And so let's talk a little bit about it. What is the title about, Fighting for Air?
Well, our big argument in the book is what we've really seen in the last decade with the transformation of our nation's media system is a devastating loss in the number of local voices out there providing the kinds of information and the cultural programming that we need to make our media system work for us. That there's a fight for air in the sense that there's a gasping for life when you spend time talking to people in cities and towns of all shapes and sizes in this country. But there's also a political fight, and the second part of the story that I tell in Fighting for Air is the story of the emergence of a media reform movement. It's a story you know well. Free Press is a big part of it, but it actually has many dimensions I hope we can explore today.
Yeah. Eric, I think one of the things that makes your book interesting, and I think it's a book that a lot of people have responded to favorably, is that it mixes sort of your academic experience with your journalistic experience, and it combines a fairly rich historical and policy-driven analysis with a lot of very human stories and a lot of stories about what's actually happening in everyday people's lives around the country that you're able to mix in. And the book opens with, I think, an anecdote or a story about consolidation in radio that's really rather extraordinary. And some people have heard of it, but very few Americans are quite familiar with it. And I think it's worth repeating it because it really puts in graphic terms what we're talking about when we talk about the consolidation of media ownership and radio in local communities. And, of course, what I'm referring to is the incident in Minot, North Dakota, 4 years ago. Could you just tell folks a little bit about that?
I will. I want to tell the story. It's an important story, and I also want to say at the outset that the big idea for this book was really to turn media consolidation from an abstraction into the kind of thing that we recognize as affecting our lives. And no matter how many times we see those charts of media ownership with five or six companies that dominate the system and own lots and lots of subsidiaries, a key challenge for us, for those of us who care about this issue, is, I think, to tell human stories about it that really resonate, especially with people who aren't already convinced that there's a problem here. And the kind of media system we have, it deprives us of those stories. And so we really need to we need to find a way to get them told. And the opening of the book, I think, is perhaps the most dramatic and illustrative case of this. 5 years ago, in January of 2002, a train derailed outside of Minot, North Dakota. That's a town of about 40,000 people. And the train spilled 240,000 gallons of anhydrous ammonia. Very quickly, that ammonia formed a toxic cloud that grew to be about 5 miles long and 2.5 miles wide. It penetrated the homes of 15,000 people in town. And, well, you know, anhydrous is a dangerous chemical. If you breathe it in, it will burn your respiratory system. It burns your eyes, burns the skin. If you breathe enough of it in, it can kill you. And
I think I'd have an injury just trying to pronounce it.
And it took me a while. It took a while to get mine it right also. But this night, you know, people started to do what all of us have been trained to do since the 1950s, really, which is when there's a disaster where you live, you turn on the broadcast radio because that's the most reliable source of emergency information. During disasters, in mine at that morning, but also in other disasters as well, the power often goes out, and so a television set is useless. In many cases, the phone lines get overwhelmed. Cell phone towers aren't working right, so we really depend on broadcast radio. And that night, when people turned on their radios to get information, instead what they got are the same smooth-talking DJs and canned music, you know, Big Country and classic rock, the same stuff that plays all the time.
And there were songs.
Yeah, and there was a reason for it. Actually, I should say that I have the transcripts of the call to 911 that night, and I use them to tell the story in the book. It's a story maybe some people have heard a little bit about, but it's really told in detail here. And you can sense the profound estrangement that people feel, like there's a disaster happening immediately where they live. And when they turn on the radio, it's like there's a soundtrack for another movie playing. It's just profoundly estranging. And so the reason that you couldn't get emergency information on that night is the local officials in Minot tried to use their emergency alert system, which would have allowed them to override the broadcast. And the technology failed. It was a fairly new technology. It didn't work. And so they did the next best thing. They picked up the phone and they called KCJB, which is the emergency broadcaster in town, the designated broadcaster. And no one answered the phone. And they realized immediately they were in trouble because KCJB, like all six of the non-religious commercial stations in Minot, was owned and operated by Clear Channel Communications, this radio giant based in San Antonio. And not only had they emptied out the studios and had no one, no live human being responsive, they didn't even have anyone available to answer the phone and issue an alert. This is a disaster made of public policy because, you know, 25 years ago, it was illegal for any one company to own an AM, more than an AM and an FM radio station in the same market. And we changed the law to allow companies like Clear Channel to dominate towns, and the result are empty studios too much of the time.
Our guest today, Eric Kleinenberg, the author of the brand new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, published this year, just recently, by Metropolitan Books. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I want to apologize. This week we're doing a remote broadcast, so I'm in on a phone line. There's nothing wrong with your radio or your computer if you're listening to this. Please bear with us today. It's just a one-time inconvenience. I'll be back to you on the high-quality ISDN lines you're used to in the listening audience. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to speak with Eric Kleinenberg, the number here at WILL is 217-333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And, Eric, I think one of the things you talk about in the book that is really quite striking is that for a lot of people, and I think I was one of them and you were one of them, most Americans felt this way, you sort of assumed growing up that the media system sort of naturally a certain way
that
evolved,
right,
as the American way with advertising and owners. And then at a certain point in the last few years, a lot of Americans realized that it isn't naturally one way or another, but it's actually made by laws and policies that have a dramatic effect on the sort of media people get.
Yeah, and people started to experience that, the idea that this was an unnatural media system when they got used to being able to rely on the airwaves, at least for emergency information, but also, I should say, for ordinary cultural programming that reflected the distinctive sounds and styles of each of our hometowns. When people started to hear this profound change in our media system over the last decade as we changed the ownership laws, I think it started to hit home that this is not something we need to passively accept. And one of the things that I chronicled in the course of writing this book, and I should say I spent about 5 years researching it, and I traveled across the country. I spent time with, you know, media producers and also with the people who make media policy and also just with ordinary citizens. I started to witness the emergence of organizations, you know, very local organizations everywhere I went, of people who were spending more and more of their time trying to make a better, more accountable media system. And of course, at the national level, we now have a new fleet of organizations doing this as well. I think Americans are growing convinced that the organizations and eight federal agencies charged with making sure our media is competitive at the local level, that it has a diverse set of voices that reflects the diversity of this country, and also that it provides an adequate level of local information, that those agencies have failed that responsibility, and people are upset.
Eric Kleinenberg, our guest today, Media Matters. Eric, well, let's follow up this point before we get to the phone lines. Tell a little bit about the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and what that did to radio, how that changed radio specifically, since that act, which you write about in Fighting for Air, is really such a central part of the story.
It is a sea change moment in recent American media history. Really, since the 1980s and the Reagan administration, we've seen a push to what you've called to re-regulate the media, essentially to loosen the ownership caps. Media companies, after all, don't want an end to regulation. If you own a broadcast station, you demand regulation from the government. Otherwise, anyone could broadcast right over your signal. So to re-regulate in a direction that favored corporations at the expense of the public, and we really saw that in 1996. That year, a Republican Congress, it was the first term of Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, joined with the Clinton White House to pass an act that raised the local radio ownership limits from 4 stations to 8 in the largest markets, and that also eliminated the national radio ownership cap altogether. And an incredible thing happened. This was a small-time industry full of independent broadcasters, you know, mom-and-pop operations that had always been fairly competitive in American life and had always been very local. And in 2 years' time, between 1996 and 1998, 40% of America's commercial broadcast radio stations changed hands. One company, Clear Channel, grew to more than 1,200 stations in a few years, and about 5 or 6 large corporations started to dominate the market. And what they realized at the corporate level is that they could make radio more profitable than ever by centralizing operations. And they set up these central studios in towns throughout the country where they would use the most sophisticated digital technology to create a network system in which they could not just syndicate programs, but literally fake local broadcasts. So they hired staff who would, in about a 30-minute period, record a 4-hour program using digital technology so they didn't have to listen to all the music. And the DJs would talk as if they were in towns where they had in fact never been. And they also, the radio stations, started firing local DJs, local personalities, back office staff throughout the country. And I think Americans today have heard the difference. Most people I know have tuned off of broadcast radio altogether, commercial at the commercial music level especially.
Our guest today, Eric Kleinenberg. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Please pardon again the connection on my line. I'm at a remote location over a phone line. It's not your radio. It's not your computer. Eric Kleinenberg, our guest, is the author of the brand-new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, just out at the Metropolitan Books, which has received a tremendous amount of acclaim and recognition already. I had the privilege of reading it in draft form. And it is a book I urge anyone who listens to this show, who really cares about the issues we talk about frequently on this program, and who care about this radio station, WILL AM 580, I think you'll find this book fascinating and of the utmost importance. We have a couple of callers waiting patiently to go on air. I want to get them 1 second, but before we go there, let me tell you the phone numbers here at WILL AM 580, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hey, you know what? When I hear a Clear Channel station and I can hear it, I turn it off. And you alluded to about the same thing recently. You said all the people you know have kind of tuned out of commercial radio in the music spectrum, right?
Yes.
Well, I am not an economist, but it would seem to me that the market should decide that. Like, if you know that nobody wants to listen to that station, then it must be very hard to sell advertising. The reason radio exists is not to inform the public, but to deliver, you know, ears to advertisers. That's what commercial radio is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't there be kind of a free market solution to this? Couldn't we open up more radio stations and allow more people and make it just so Clear Channel couldn't buy all those stations? And if they could, make it so that you can broadcast free over the internet or something. Like, isn't there some way to do this without closing down business that was legally purchased?
Yeah, let me tell you what's going on in the industry right now. It's
fascinating. That question, if I could say, Eric, I think gets at so many good issues.
You
just took about half the questions on my list I had in front of me.
Well, there are a lot of ways to respond to it. I mean,
I'm going to hang up because the guy told me to, so I'll talk to you in a minute.
Okay.
I'll listen.
One of the big stories that I report in the book, whether it's the radio industry or the television industry or newspapers, is as chain companies started to dilute the quality of content, they literally started chasing their audience off the air. They're chasing their audience away in the case of newspapers off the air, in the case of radio stations. And they've really suffered because of this. In some cases, companies have begun to bust up. In the radio industry, the spectrum is fairly precious, and it's very difficult to get a license to have a full-power radio station. What's happened with Clear Channel is that when they would go into a market, they would get 6, 7, 8 stations, and the market itself would be far less competitive, and it would be difficult for another organization to try to compete. And here I should be clear that one reason it was so difficult for small broadcasters to compete with Clear Channel is that Clear Channel is not just the radio stations. They also own the largest syndicator company in the country, Premier Radio Networks, which owns the Dr. Laura Show and Rush Limbaugh and dozens of others. Actually, more than half of America's commercial radio stations, non-Clear Channel stations, depend on Clear Channel programming because they use syndicated services. And Clear Channel also owns the largest company that does block advertising for radio in the country. They own more live entertainment venues for musicians, for concerts than anyone else. They own all this outdoor advertising space, so it's very difficult for an individual operator to compete with Clear Channel. And so what that meant is actually dysfunctional markets. And this is one reason why among the strongest critics of media consolidation in this country are economic libertarians like William Safire, the former New York Times columnist, who say, if we're going to have a market corporate media system, it's got to be competitive at the local level. And we haven't had that. So in recent years, what people have done is they've turned off the radio and gone to iPod and the Internet and satellite and other places. And that meant that, Clear Channel, which used to have about 20 minutes of advertising for every hour of programming, which is an extraordinary ratio, started to scale back on advertising. And they actually even started to invest a little bit more in local content. But in many ways, it was too late. They had chased so many people off the dial. Now what they're doing is they're trying to sell the company. They're also saying they want to sell the stations they have in small and mid-sized markets, and they're probably going to sell it to a more of a mid-sized chain companies if that goes through. But at the same time, they're pushing to expand the radio ownership caps at the local level from 8 to 10 or 12. So they want to have an even bigger presence in the biggest markets. And here we need to be clear that we don't have a kind of free, open market system where everything is kind of working according to pure market principles. We have highly regulated media markets, and the story I'm telling is a story in which we've really destroyed competition at the local level. Now, one thing I need to add at the end is that we are actually entering into a very rare historic moment. Sometime in April or May this year, the FCC will be licensing high-power radio stations for the first time in about 20 years, and groups withstanding at the local levels can find out whether they're they're candidates to get a full-power FM radio license. And I would encourage you to go to the Prometheus Radio Project website or to the Free Press website at freepress.net and find out more about this process. It's an important thing.
Our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, professor of sociology at NYU and author of the brand new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, published this year by Metropolitan Books. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. And that's prometheusradio.org. My producer has just sent me over instant message. The number here, 217-333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the media reform movement, its dramatic emergence in the last 5 years, and especially how local citizens have been concerned in fighting back, specifically around the decline of radio in their communities, which has traditionally been such a great local medium. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. To Champagne again on line two. Line two, Champagne, you're with us.
Thank you. Granted, it's been a few years since I was involved in radio, but as I recall back then, when the inspectors came around, the very first thing they checked was the emergency broadcast system. And if it was not in compliance, it was you know, there were heavy fines that would be levied. It was abundantly clear. And I'm just wondering, what were the consequences for Clear Channel over this incident in Minot?
Well, there's a longstanding dispute between Clear Channel and the emergency officials in Minot over on whose end the system broke down. And Clear Channel insists that the fault lies with the local officials whose emergency alert system didn't work. The local officials say that Clear Channel is at fault. The bottom line point for me is that when a technology breaks down, what you really need to make sure of is that you can find live human beings who work at the station who are capable of dealing with the technological breakdown. Let's remember that technologies break down all the time, and this was a fairly new one when the Minot disaster happened. And when you have a consolidated radio market where there's one company that has six stations, as they did in Minot, what often happens, this is the economic reason for doing it, is they merge the offices together. So instead of having six offices with six sets of DJs and six sets of back office workers, you have one or two offices, and that means if there's no one there, there's definitely no one there. There's no way to find anyone for all of those stations. And so I think the problem is not merely with the emergency alert system technically, it's also with the problem of having small staffs in our media companies and having corporate owners that are totally unaccountable because they're not connected to the town. In fact, in many cases, they probably can't even name the town where they own five or six stations.
Yeah, Eric Kleinberg, we've talked about music and localism, but one of the other great services of commercial radio broadcasting and non-commercial radio broadcasting historically in the United States, certainly prior to the 1990s, was that it was a primary source of local news and local news coverage in communities. What is the state of local news coverage on radio today, and how does that factor into your story?
Well, this is a fairly dramatic thing, and I spent time, you know, talking to radio personalities in every city where I went, and the reports I got were uniform and consistent, that essentially the radio reporting has been eviscerated as an industry, especially on the commercial dial. And some towns that are large enough, there's an all-news AM station that has a radio staff of, you know, 5-6 to 15 people at a big city. But and again, public radio stations sometimes have a few people who do truly local reporting, but for the most part, you know, radio reporting is gone as an industry.
Our guest today, Eric Kleinberg, again. And Eric, you know, this book is a very popular book. It's not a book that's a dry academic tome, and you are a professor at NYU, a prominent university and a prominent department of sociology. Mm-hmm. How does a work like this play for your career as an academic?
Well, you know, I think we'll see about that. But I wrote the book the way I did because I felt like I had no choice. I mean, I entered into this field. I wanted to write about media consolidation because I understood it was something that was really changing the way that our communications worked in this country. And I started a kind of standard academic project, and it became clear to me that we are really at a pivotal moment in this country. There is so much that's at stake right now as we debate how to set ownership rules for media companies, as we enter into the digital frontier and start to set policies about net neutrality and equal access online. It's also clear to me that there are, I think for the first time in generations, millions of Americans from all regional locations, from all political persuasions, you know, the religious conservatives and progressives from Move On, working together because they're so concerned about what's going to happen with our media system collectively. And when I started seeing these communications breakdowns like the one in Minot, or there are several other stories like this described in the book, and when I started to observe this, you know, what had happened to local television news, for example, or when I watched the Sinclair Broadcast Group, the company that owns more television affiliate stations than any other corporation in the United States, use its broadcast stations to try to sway the outcome of the 2004 election, you know, threatening to air the Stolen Honor or Swift Boat documentary about John Kerry, or refusing to allow its ABC affiliates to air the Ted Koppel special on Nightline where he read the names of all the American war casualties in Iraq. I just felt like I couldn't live with myself if I just wrote a standard dry academic treatise. I had to write a work of more public sociology, the way that, you know, C. Wright Mills might have done a few generations ago, and try to be part of this, because it seems to me like the stories I tell in this book are not stories that you're going to read about on the front page of your newspaper. They're not stories that you hear on commercial radio. You do not see them on cable TV news, on network TV news. And yet they touch the heart of what's happening in our country right now. So I guess my answer to your question is, this is a moment where I decided I wasn't going to think so much about my career and I was going to try to do what was right.
Our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, phone number here at WILL-AM580 is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Phone lines are open. Eric Kleinenberg, you just alluded to how concern about this issue cuts across the political spectrum. Your book chronicles this, I think, really well. And as someone who's attended a lot of the public hearings, it's always been striking to me that this is not a matter that breaks down strictly along ideological or partisan political lines. Yet at the same time, you look at Washington, D.C., and you see the politicians and how they vote in this, and it does largely break down along partisan lines. Yeah, you attended the Memphis Conference on Media Reform, as I did roughly a month ago and 4 weeks ago, and it was overwhelmingly liberal or left. There were precious few Republicans, or at least ones who wanted to admit they were Republicans there. How bipartisan or nonpartisan is this movement?
Well, I think the movement itself is truly bipartisan, and I think the nature of coalitions is that sometimes they work best when there's a little bit of a distance between the different players. I mean, we're talking about organizations. If we talk about the ACLU and the National Rifle Association, or the MoveOn.org and the Christian Coalition, the Parents Television Council, and NOW. These are all organizations that probably have a lot to fight about. And to some extent, the coalitions in politics work when you find a shared set of interests and you agree to work at the legislative level and to establish a rationale for your position together to make sure that you're speaking with a strong voice and you're making the big arguments. And I think you can do that even if you keep yourself separated on a broader set of political issues. Now, there is a tighter relationship between the Republican Party and some of the philosophies that have guided the push to loosen ownership laws in this country. And I think Republicans, far more than Democrats, have tried to transform government in all areas by getting rid of regulatory measures, regardless of the issue. Not that Democrats haven't played a heavy role in this, and my book documents the way the Clinton administration in particular played a key role in the 96 Telecommunications Act. But look, let's face it, even though the Americans are so united on this issue, really across party lines, politicians historically have been united in their reluctance to regulate media companies for another set of reasons. First of all, every politician knows that the media has tremendous capacity to determine his or her fate at the ballot box. A media company at the local level can decide how much airtime to give a candidate, what kind of coverage to give a candidate. They can even decide when a candidate's advertisements are going to be played, during primetime hours or in early morning hours. Political officials are extremely concerned about the power of media companies. But the media companies, and this is another story I tell, and hopefully in a somewhat dramatic fashion, they are huge lobbyists. They are major donors to political parties. Many observers have argued that the FCC is a captured agency, literally in the grips of the industry it's supposed to regulate. And one vivid example of this, I think, is that before the 2003 FCC's ownership hearings, Michael Powell, Colin Powell's son, was the chairman at the time. Media companies gave almost $3 million to pay for trips, junkets, for not just FCC staffers, but the commissioners and the chairman himself. And I'm talking about, media policy trips to hotspots like Rio de Janeiro and Hong Kong and Paris. And you wonder, is this an agency that's really capable of having the ethical independence it needs to meet its public interest obligations? The Center for Public Integrity, which is a nonpartisan watchdog organization in Washington, D.C., just issued a report showing that in the last decade, communications companies contributed something like $500 million to the political parties, and that's not saying anything about the lobbying. And Ed Markey, the congressman from Massachusetts, who's now going to be running the House Telecommunications Committee, told the gathering in Memphis that the communications companies have an individual lobbyist assigned to each single member of Congress. So although this is a bipartisan movement, it has tremendous resistance on Capitol Hill, and it needs to be overwhelmingly strong if it's going to do anything in the battles coming up this year.
Our guest, Eric Klinenberg, author of the new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. The number here at WILL AM 580, 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. We've got someone from line 4, Bloomington, Illinois. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I want to ask a question about I heard a movement of I think it's called low-powered radio stations that people can take applications for in smaller, medium markets. And also, being a DJ from the 70s and 80s, how is the pirate radio station movement? I know that kind of fizzled out, but it seems like now you kind of almost need a upswing in that type of movement, because this is something else with the big media conglomerates just taking over the entire band.
Well, this is actually a theme of the book, so this is a perfect question for you, Eric.
It is, and it's a great story. And again, I wish this is a story that we knew more about, but you know, we don't get it from the normal places we turn for news. There's a chapter in the book called "Low Power to the People," and it deals exactly with this issue, both the history of pirate radio and also what's happened with low power FM radio. It really kind of a booming area in media policy. I mean, this country has a great tradition of amateur operators on the airwaves. And Bob, in your first book, you write about what happened to the amateur operators during the nation's first broadcast policy-making decision. We decided to go far more corporate, and we moved a lot of the amateur and pirate operators off the dial, or we actually turned amateurs into pirates. I tell the story of an organization called Radio Mutiny in West Philadelphia. They a few people working out of a private home there doing a pirate station that had all sorts of community programs. And, you know, Americans throughout the country realized that they just weren't getting what they needed in terms of music, in terms of culture programming from the commercial stations. And they just started in the 1990s this profusion of their own stations, pirate radio stations, operating without a license. Then, in recent years, there's been a push to force the FCC or to demand that the FCC provide more low-power FM licenses so that you wouldn't have to operate in violation of the law. You could actually get approval to do it. And there's been a tremendous fight on this in this area. The organization I named before, the Prometheus Radio Project, has a project now where they go around the country and they help communities set up their own low-power stations. They do these things they call barn raisings that are really fantastic.
There was one, in fact, in Urbana, Eric, about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, they're great events. They're very important events. And the story to know is that Radio Mutiny and Prometheus have done this incredible work of dramatizing how silly the FCC has been at barring small communities and any community really from having a station like this. The FCC started to bust private stations, pirate radio stations, and the people at Radio Mutiny knew they were about to get crushed, and so they openly defied the FCC. They said, "We're going to have a protest march in front of the Benjamin Franklin Printing Press in Philadelphia, and if you want to arrest us, you know, we invite you as FCC members to come down and do it." And the FCC didn't. So they then said, "Well, we're going to step this up. We're going to go to Washington, D.C., and we're going to do a protest rally. We're going to march to the FCC and then to the National Association of Broadcasters, which is the big lobbying organization for the industry." They went to D.C., and when they got to the NAB, these are pirate radio people, remember, they literally took down, they captured the NAB flag, and they put up a pirate radio. They put up the Jolly Roger, which was flying at the NAB, and they essentially humiliated the federal agencies in this country into agreeing that it made no sense. It was hypocrisy to allow the biggest corporate owners to have even more of the spectrum at the same time that they knocked individual Americans and communities being misserved off the dial. So they got some concessions from the FCC, and one of the stories I tell in the book is that just when the FCC started to open up and say, "We are now going to allow more low-power FM licenses," an incredibly unlikely coalition on the other side emerged. The National Association of Broadcasters started working with National Public Radio, which is an incumbent player on the educational side of the dial on the FM, and they changed that legislation. So instead of new licenses for low-power operators in big cities as well as small towns, today there are only licenses available for people in small towns. And there are some, but the last thing I'll say on this issue is that organized religious groups have been tremendously effective at getting the licenses and also the transmitters that make those licenses more powerful. And a lot of people are concerned that, as kind of individual community members, you're either up against organized capital or organized religion, and it's a very tough fight.
Our guest again today, Eric Kleinenberg, author of the brand new book, Fighting for Error, The Battle to Control America's Media, just published by Metropolitan Books. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL, AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The phone number here, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple people patiently waiting, but before I get back to the phone lines, I do have another follow-up question I want to do, really going back to the first caller, Eric Kleinenberg.
Yeah.
Here comes the Internet, and everyone's online. More people listen to this radio program online than do over the air now. At some point down the road, I might not need to be, or not just me, but any show might not even be need to be broadcast over the air if it can be online. Does the Internet change everything? Does it make this really a moot discussion?
Well, the Internet changes a lot, but in my view, it makes this discussion all the more important because what we really care about, ultimately, is the quality of the content that we get, not necessarily the delivery system itself. And I'm an Internet junkie. You can ask anybody in my family. It can be a problem to pry me off the computer. I love it because at my fingertips, I can get news and information from all over the world like never before, like the news from South Africa or from England or from Buenos Aires. It's a tremendous resource. But when it comes down to getting news and information and cultural programming about my hometown, the place where I live, I can't turn to the Internet for supplemental news and information. In fact, the same voices, like my local newspaper, for example, get amplified online. I become more dependent on them than ever, and they appear in many different places. And so what I'm concerned about, and actually in the book I argue that the idea that the Internet replaces all these other media is the most dangerous myth of the digital age. What I'm concerned about is with our enthusiasm for the bloggers and the grassroots journalists, all these people doing really exciting and important independent media work, we'll forget how dependent we remain on, for example, professional journalism. I mean, let's not think that professional journalism exists because God ordained it or because the most powerful institutions in this country want to have good watchdogs out there. I mean, there's big, powerful institutions have no interest in good journalism, and journalism as a profession has taken decades to build up to be a serious check on power. And I'm concerned that as we get rid of investigative reporters, as we get rid of radio reporters, as we get rid of beat reporters, all of these people, we get our news starts to miss important stories. And I'm also concerned at the cultural level with radio that as we fire local DJs, our ears move off the ground and we stop getting kind of new music, new cultural programming that percolates up from cities up to the national level. Like Philadelphia won't sound like Philadelphia and Chicago won't sound like Chicago. And instead we'll get a kind of top-down, totally corporate media system that plays to the lowest common denominator and makes our culture less interesting. So no, the Internet is not the solution to everything. It does make things interesting, though.
Eric Kleinenberg, what would you do if I made you head of the FCC for a day and gave you power to enact any policy reform you wanted to improve the situation of media in general, or say radio specifically? What sort of things would you be considering?
Well, there's a couple things that I think we need to deal with. Probably the most pressing issue for Americans dealing with media policy today has to do with the future of the Internet. We need network neutrality provisions that give us all equal access to every website online. It will be a public interest disaster in this country if the telephone and cable companies that control our access to media can give faster sites to deep-pocketed corporations and put everybody else in the slow lane. It will block innovation. As we move more and more of our media through broadband connections, from everything from television to telephone, we'll need equal access to all Internet sites, all of the stuff online. So that's a huge issue. Another issue that we need to know about is that despite all the problems with this relaxed ownership situation I've talked about, the relaxed ownership caps, the industry is now pushing for even greater relaxations. And in the next 6 months, the chairman of the FCC, Kevin Martin, could raise radio ownership caps to 10 or 12 in big cities. He could get rid of the 31-year-old ban that prevents a newspaper company from also owning a television station and radio stations. We might have a law that makes a company able to own all the newspapers in your town, 10 or 12 radio stations, 3 television stations, the cable system, the most popular internet sites. I'm very concerned about this. So those are things that I think I would block immediately if I were chair of the FCC. And then the other thing I think we might start to talk about as the media reform movement stops being defensive and starts to actually go on the offensive and create a better media system for Americans is to say, there is no, why should we allow major corporations to own 1,200 radio stations or 60 television stations? I mean, I could imagine a time when we start to break up these media companies, if not by dictate, then at least by a serious license renewal challenge. You know, it used to be the case that every broadcast station, which we need to be clear about this, they're broadcasting over the public airwaves, which are public resources like national parks. I mean, they don't own the airwaves. They get a license to use it for a certain amount of time. What if we put some teeth into the license renewal process in this country and communities that challenge a broadcast license on the basis of the owner's failure to serve the public interest actually got a reasonable and serious hearing every 7 years when they now come up? I mean, this would be a potentially great thing. Let's do something to make corporate broadcasters more accountable to us.
We've got a couple of very patient callers waiting to speak with Eric Kleinenberg, our guest today, Media Matters. Eric Kleinenberg, again, the author of the brand new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, really the first great book out to chronicle the emerging media reform movement in the United States. And it's a wonderful story written not only with scholarly expertise, but really with a journalistic flair, a real appreciation of the human side of these policies and what's going on in community after community in the United States today. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Beamant. I hope I've got that right. Illinois, you're on the air.
Yeah, Beamant. Anyway, the first low-power broadcaster I believe that was ever known of was a guy named Abana Kataka, I believe is his name. His original name was Dwayne Redis. He's an African-American in Springfield, Illinois, who lived in these housing projects and began his station to start reporting on police abuse of people in that project. And consequently, he started being really hassled by law enforcement. And I have a video some people shot that is hilarious. See, this is in the mid to late 1980s, where he went to the FCC office in Springfield and tried to turn himself in, and these people were just mystified. They had no idea what was going on. And now you have, like, drug enforcement agency-type raids on people who are broadcasting that way. Another thing real quickly, it's disingenuous for the FCC to ban low-power stations in large cities and allow them in small communities, because in a large city in Manhattan, you could have millions of listeners with a low-power station, whereas the one in Urbana, Illinois, maybe has just 10 to 20,000 at most, because the signal's so small and the population density is so small. And
yes.
Number 3, about the Christians, Champaign's community radio station has to hire a service to watch the FCC because Christian stations located thousands of miles away are constantly trying to put translators in Decatur on our frequency. And
yeah.
I'll hang up.
Now, those are all great points, and I'll say that the stories of all of them, including the Kentenko story in Springfield, are really elaborated in Fighting for Air, so you can read about all those issues there. It's so important for us to know these stories and to tell these stories, and I can't emphasize enough. I mean, I think we're at a point today where the challenge for media reformers, for people who think we can make a better media system, is to persuade other people who are not already part of this project that their interests are at stake here. And I think the way to do that is that we need to not just have the right statistics, not just have those dramatic posters, not just have even the right arguments, but we really need these stories. And I think if I could make any contribution to the debate, it's to try to provide some of those stories so that when you explain to other people why this matters so much, you have them at your disposal. My experience, you know, I've now been on this book tour for a couple weeks. The book just came out 3 weeks ago, is that when I talk to people about the mine at North Dakota's or the story of low-power FM radio or the story of Sinclair Broadcast Group or Tribune and in the newspaper industry cutting jobs in L.A. and other markets, most Americans still do not know that this is happening. They don't see it on the television news. They don't read it in the newspaper. So we need to start telling these stories ourselves.
What sort of response, Eric Kleinenberg, have you gotten to the book from people and audiences, from readers already, or from reviewers and critics?
Well, this is a contentious issue. So, I'm having arguments with that. You know, there are people out there who believe very strongly that media ownership does not matter anymore. In the age of the internet, I find that they don't engage the actual arguments in my book. There's a kind of ideology about this that has driven a lot of media policymaking in the last several years. But what's really exciting, I have to say, is going to speak in different places in the country and watching just the profound interest that people have in this issue. You know, Americans are often complaining about how lethargic and despondent their that fellow citizens are. We complain about the lack of knowledge, the lack of energy, all these things. But you mentioned these FCC hearings that have taken place across the country, and Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, the two dissenting FCC commissioners, have played a role in this. When you go to a community and talk about what's happening to their TV stations, their radio stations, their newspapers, you get a lot of turnout, and people are very interested, and they'll stay for hours to talk about it. And so when I go to do book events, you know, the turnouts are terrific. People want to know these stories. We have long debates that, you know, last for a good time. And the important thing, I think, is not necessarily that we all agree on every single issue, but that we start to talk about them and we recognize that these are issues that we can take into our own hands, because there's a history in this country of media policy being made in a profoundly anti-democratic manner. I mean, you could even say that Michael Powell, the last FCC chairman, seemed to be hostile to democratic sentiment. He did what he wanted to do and ignored millions of letters that came into him. I think the thing for us to be doing is just to make sure that we're talking about these issues and making our concerns public.
We have time for one more caller for our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, the author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. Let's go now to line one, Urbana. You're on the air, and thank you for your patience.
Professor Kleinenberg, if you would permit a political question. At the recent March on Washington to end the war in Iraq, why were there no media reform stars present? No Phil Donahue, no Bill Moyers, let alone Ralph Nader. Not even Cindy Sheehan was present on that podium. Was this an orchestrated Democratic Party event? Thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of the march and who organized it. I can say that Jane Fonda, who was one of the keynote speakers at the Media Reform March, the Media Reform Conference in Memphis this year, was also there in D.C. I think, look, we have a number of issues that people who want social justice in this country are fighting for, and I can guarantee you that there was lots of overlap in the crowd that came to Memphis for media reform and the crowd that went to D.C. to march on Iraq. The point for us is not to fight about who's doing which particular jobs, but just to make sure that the coalitions of interest remain strong and that people find ways to support each other on all these issues, and that it doesn't matter if the main thing that you're concerned about in the world is Iraq or global warming or racial justice or any or immigration, you name the issue. Media reform has got to be up there on your list as number two or possibly close by, because every one of your issues gets filtered through this thing. So I think it's not a time to try to be more divisive. It's a time to think about the connections between all these projects.
You know, Eric Kleinenberg, someone reads your terrific book, Fighting for Air, and they're impressed by it and they're convinced that this is something important. I suspect you've heard this question already. What do you tell them to do? What do you say? Where do I go, Professor Kleinenberg? Where do I turn? How do I participate in this? Where do I learn more?
Well, I mean, I would say that, but I'll try not to embarrass you here, but I think the great resource for work on this at the national level right now is the Free Press website. And go to freepress.net online, and whether what you care about most is the future of the internet or payola on the radio or media ownership or fake local news, you will find information about how to connect to national organizations working on these things on the Free Press website. And I should also say the story of the of Free Press and its emergence is told in Fighting for Air as well. The other thing is that in every town I visited, as I've said, there is a local organization that's doing work on media reform. And there are some people who, you know, it's a big movement. Some people are attracted to the independent media production side of this movement. They want to produce their own media because they're fed up with what's out there. Find an indie media producer in your neighborhood, your community. Other people want to do media criticism, and there's lots of space for watchdog reporting. You know, what are your broadcasters doing? What is your newspaper covering and not covering? Try to make them more accountable. And other people really care about these policy fights. I'd say that's the third kind of emerging domain of media policy activism. I guarantee you there is a local organization where you live doing work on this. You can go to freepress.net. You can go to Common Cause. There are many ways in.
Do you have any idea what your next project is going to be, Eric? Do you have any media, or are you going to head off into something else? Your first book was an award-winning and extraordinarily highly acclaimed book, Heat Wave, about the great heat wave in Chicago in 1995 that killed, I think, 700 people. And so are you going to stay in media, or are you going to head in a different direction, do you think?
Well, I'm staying in media for a long time. I'm going to follow these issues, and I think actually the way for me to work on these things right now is to think about the contributions you can make outside of a book. So I'm trying to write a lot of magazine stories. I'm trying to do a lot of public speaking. I'm just trying to live inside of the argument in Fighting for Air for a while again, because I think there is so much at stake. And I'd encourage everybody who cares about this issue not to buy the book, but to find the stories that resonate most for you, and make sure that when you discuss this issue with people who aren't already thinking about it quite a lot, that you have not just the kind of dry statistics with you, but that you also have the human dimension of the story down, because I think that's how all of us who care so much about this issue are going to make it something that comes to life.
Eric Kleinenberg has been our guest today. He's the author of the brand new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, just published by Metropolitan Books. It's a highly acclaimed book, and it's one that he says you don't necessarily have to buy it. Whether you buy it or not, it's not my business, but you ought to read it. Get at the library, do whatever you wish. But definitely, I think if you're interested in these issues, it's a book that it's already entered the must-read category. Eric, we've only got about 15, 20, 25 seconds left. A question I often like to ask guests on the show is what their media diet is. Quickly, what's your daily diet? Where do you learn about the world?
Well, one of the great things I have in New York City is called Gotham Gazette. It's a daily digest. There's an organization here in New York City that gets all the best local reporting from newspapers, radio, television even, and provides links. So every morning I can go there to find out about New York City. I'm a New York Times reader, a BBC reader, and I use the alternative and indie media sites as much as possible.
On that note, Eric Kleinenberg, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. Good luck with your book. We'll stay in touch. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, and I'll see you in 167 hours.